From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. We've postponed our broadcast of the debate between August Wilson and Robert Brustein on race and cultural power in the arts. We'll hear that tomorrow. On today's Fresh Air, female genital mutilation, also known as female circumcision. It's a rite of passage practiced in over 25 African countries where it is increasingly controversial. The tradition is carried out in America by some immigrants. Last year, a U.S. federal law was passed criminalizing the procedure. We'll hear from Dr. Naheed Tubia. She was the first female surgeon in Sudan, her country of birth. Now she teaches at Columbia University School of Public Health, and she directs a group which is active in the global campaign to eradicate female genital mutilation. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton is expected to use tonight's State of the Union address to push his education reform package. The president plans to introduce a new college scholarship program modeled after one in Georgia. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Joshua Leves reports.
President Clinton's HOPE scholarship proposal would provide a $1,500 annual tax credit or a $10,000 annual tax deduction to families of students who keep a B average for their first 2 years of college. Families with annual incomes of more than $100,000 would be phased out of the program. President Clinton designed the HOPE scholarship program with help from longtime political ally Georgia Governor Zell Miller. Miller spearheaded Georgia's HOPE scholarship program, which gives high school students with B averages free tuition and a $100 annual book allowance at any of the state's public colleges and universities. Georgia's HOPE scholarship program has been credited with attracting more students to post-secondary education. For National Public Radio, I'm Joshua Leves reporting.
Federal Reserve Board policymakers are meeting in Washington to decide whether to alter short-term interest rates. Most economists say they expect the rates to stay unchanged. Several point to two reports yesterday from the National Association of Purchasing Management and from the Commerce Department, which find the economy is moderating and suggest there is little risk of inflation. Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic today announced he has agreed to recognize opposition victories from last year's local elections. The announcement comes after 10 weeks of daily demonstrations by anti-government protesters in the streets of Belgrade. Paul Wood is in the Serbian capital. He says opposition leaders are cautious.
They're very optimistic about this. They've seen too many reversals over the past 11 weeks or so to be popping the champagne corks just yet. They want to wait for a couple of days and see how quickly this legislation passes through Parliament. But they do expect it to be through in a couple of days, perhaps 3 days at the most. And there is a quiet feeling of satisfaction there. I think on the streets, though, there will be a big party tonight. People won't wait for the bill to pass.
Paul Wood reporting. A published report says the Clinton administration is thinking about equipping some commercial aircraft with electronic anti-missile defense systems. The Wall Street Journal reports that a commission headed by Vice President Al Gore is calling for the systems. The commission's report did not say which aircraft are most at risk. The recommendations come as investigators continue their probe of last July's TWA air disaster. Officials are not sure whether a missile, bomb, or mechanical malfunction caused the crash in the Atlantic Ocean off Long Island. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down more than 23 points at 6,783. Trading is active. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, a private business research group says the index of leading economic indicators rose a tenth of a percent in December. The conference board says the gain is very small and a sign of a slower economic growth. The index is intended to predict economic activity 6 to 9 months in advance. The small increase suggests that the economy and inflation will remain under control through summer. Soft drink giant Coca-Cola has signed an agreement to advertise its products on CBS. The deal is worth an estimated $50 million. Bruce Dorton of Peach State Public Radio reports from Atlanta.
The deal reportedly includes an exclusive contract to advertise Coke products during the 1998 Winter Olympics. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports today the deal covers CBS programs from October through September 1998 and includes The Late Show with David Letterman, the Grammy Awards, and some yet-to-be-determined primetime shows. Coca-Cola spokesman Bob Bertini says that the Atlanta-based beverage company was increasing its ad buys on the network because of steps CBS has taken to strengthen its schedule. Bertini also says Coca-Cola would look at other opportunities on ABC, NBC, and Fox. For National Public Radio, I'm Bruce Dorton in Atlanta.
Chrysler is challenging a government recall in federal court. The automaker is suing the National Transportation Safety Board in an effort to reverse a recall of 91,000 Cirrus and Dodge Stratus cars. The government says the seatbelt system in these cars failed a standard strength test. However, Chrysler charges the test is too vague. Chrysler could face civil penalties of more than $2 million if it loses. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the New Prospect Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment and the Indiana-based Lilly Endowment Incorporated for coverage of religion.
Fresh Air support comes from William Morrow, publishers of Even the Wicked, the new Matthew Scudder mystery novel by Lawrence Block.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We had planned to bring you highlights of a debate on racial politics and theater recorded last week at New York's Town Hall. We have to postpone that broadcast until tomorrow. The lead story in this week's New York Times Week in Review was headlined, "Africa's Culture War, Old Customs, New Values." It focused in part on the increasing controversy in Africa over female genital mutilation, or FGM, which is also known as female circumcision. It's a rite of passage in which part of a girl's genitals is cut off. This is also practiced by some African immigrants in America. Last year, the U.S. Congress passed a law criminalizing female genital mutilation. Dr. Naheed Toubia has witnessed the psychological and medical effects of FGM. She's from Sudan, where FGM is still practiced. As the first woman surgeon in her country, she treated many girls and women who had undergone the procedure. Now Dr. Toubia teaches at the Columbia University School of Public Health and is the director of RAINBOW, the Research Action Information Network for Bodily Integrity of Women. The group opposes FGM but wants to protect African women from being persecuted or stigmatized. Be advised that Dr. Toubia will give explicit descriptions of FGM procedures and the medical and sexual after effects. When we spoke last year, Dr. Toubia told me there are different forms of FGM, some more extreme than others.
The simple way to describe it would be anything that touches the most sensitive part of the woman's sexual organs, which is basically the clitoris, whether it's just through a pricking or cutting or, you know, coterie, will be considered the mildest form or what we'd call type 1. So basically the commonest type 1 is removal of woman's clitoris. The next severe operation would be to remove the whole clitoris or part of what we call the smaller lips or the labia minora, which are also quite sensitive in terms of being in response to sexual arousal and sexual stimulation. So they're kind of like the clitoris and the labia are the most sensitive parts of the genitals. So the second type would be removal of both. The third and more severe type, which is very common in my country and in a lot of the countries of the Horn of Africa, is what is called type 3 or infibulation, in which apart from removing all the surface tissue that protrudes on the outside of the genitals, there's also big incisions or wounds made in the bigger lips or the outer lips, the labia majora, and then the two sides are stitched together to form a smooth hood of skin or a smooth cover of skin that covers the part where the urine comes out, the urethra, and also part of the inlet to the vaginal opening. So the woman from the front will look like she just has a smooth skin covering instead of all her external genitals and a one small hole at the back where some of the urine will trickle and later her menstruation will pass. So it's quite drastic, both in terms of surgical cutting, but also into ongoing problems that can occur from this obstruction that occurs. And then there are In the fourth type, there is a whole gamut of rare and unusually reported types of genital mutilation that are not very common, so they were all grouped one as kind of rare forms as type 4, and that's the standard classification.
What is the cultural or religious explanation that is used, for example, in Sudan, where you're from, to justify this procedure?
Religion takes a very secondary role in this, and I can talk about this a little bit later. It's very much deeply a cultural practice where women's sexuality needs to be controlled, needs to be sacrificed, and particularly in places where it's a very dramatic, like the infibulation. It's seen as a woman's sacrifice of her sexuality in favor of the social norm, the social acceptance of her womanhood as a reproductive human being who abides by her husband, by her family's morality, that her virginity is very high in her own self-esteem, and therefore a more acceptable form of fertility that is devoid almost of sexuality is her pride in herself. That is not necessarily as extreme as this in every society. You'll find different justifications in different societies. But I think from all the work we've done learning about this in the 28 African countries where this is now more prevalent, the bottom line, it's some form of control of women's sexual response.
Is infibulation almost as if you're making a woman's genital organs into a chastity belt?
Absolutely. And it will actually, much of the time, it needs another interference to open it up again.
In other words, it has to be cut in order to have intercourse or in order to have childbirth.
Yeah. I mean, intercourse can happen, but it takes a long, long time, a very, very slow process of gradual dilatation. But in many cases, yes, the woman would have to be recut for intercourse. And for childbirth, it's 100%. Every woman who has infibulation has to be recut for childbirth.
And then do they get sewn up again afterwards?
Yes, the majority traditionally would prefer to get sewn up again for a couple of reasons. One is the whole, I think, unfortunate and sad misconception in some of these societies as to what sexuality is about, both for women and for men. So it's perceived that men also prefer the woman to have a very tight opening. It gives them the feeling that they're opening up a virgin again, even if she's had 5 children. Men are programmed to think about it like that, although increasingly as more research and more openness about this issue is coming forth, we're learning that men are suffering from that too. So the resewing is partly for that, but there's also another issue about the resewing. A lot of these women have now have a body image that is based on them not having tissue that secretes mucus and it's not open to the outside. And so if they're left open, unsewed again, they feel very strange. They feel naked, basically, and they feel very uncomfortable with themselves.
More vulnerable.
More vulnerable and just exposed to the world that they're not longer protected.
Are there any myths about women's sexuality and women's bodies that are used to rationalize genital mutilation?
I don't know how much of the myths still persist in today's society, but when we do research a little bit in history, maybe 50, 100 years ago, many African countries perceived of women's sexuality as being very wild and much more potent and powerful than male sexuality. And that if a woman is left in her own wild state, she will exhaust her man, she will override him, and therefore she will be able to, she will need to go astray. So there are such myths. Even amongst Muslim communities, so that might be surprising to many people who only perceive of Muslim women as very timid and very shy about their sexuality. As a matter of fact, Islam as a religion perceives of women's sexuality as very powerful and potent, and could be detrimental to a man's self-esteem or his own sexuality. So there is a lot of, unlike Christian ethic of women's sexuality being secondary or is subdued, it actually, there's a lot of portrayal of women's sexuality as very potent.
The procedure we're talking about is now often called female genital mutilation, and that's the term that human rights activists are using to describe it. It's also sometimes called female circumcision. Do you think that there's any comparison between, you know, the female version of this and male circumcision?
Yes and no. On the no is on the anatomical side. Male circumcision constitutes removal of the skin that covers the tip of the penis, which is the prepuce. Now, anatomically, there is an exact equivalent to that, which is a small piece of skin that covers or surrounds the clitoris. But it's much, much smaller, of course, and especially in children. We're talking here about children who get circumcision at the age of 3 or 4 or 5. So that piece of skin is very small in girls that it'd be almost impossible to dissect and remove without damaging the clitoris itself. So in those anatomical terms, no, there is no comparison. The mildest form of circumcision of the popular types would actually be like removing the tip of the penis or half of the penis. So in that sense, they're not comparable because of the drastic effect of a female circumcision on the woman. But the other more important point which the human rights perspective has brought to this is the right of the child to their body integrity or the intactness of their body, and that these are non-consenting children. And the question is, how much do parents have the right to interfere with the normal body of a child based on a cultural belief or religious belief or ritualistic belief or whatever.
What are your opinions on that?
When I first started this work, maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I just dismissed it. Oh, they're not the same. You know, that was just my immediate, based primarily because I'm a doctor. I couldn't see that the damage is anywhere the same. So I just used to say, no, they're not the same. But as I became much more a human rights activist and learned more about the basics and ethics of human rights, I think now I have a belief that children should be left intact, male or female. And if they do choose, like all adults, choose to do things to themselves after the age of consent, whether it's because, you know, you want to pierce your nose or you want to do a plastic surgery to your breasts or whatever you want to do, you don't do it except after the age of 21. The fact that this is linked to culture or religion should also be left to the individual. Of course, that brings the medical argument that circumcisions in adults could be potentially more hazardous than in children. But I think with modern science, that need not be a big issue. So basically, the short of it is I believe children should be intact, male or female.
My guest is Dr. Naheed Toubia. She was the first woman surgeon in Sudan and now teaches at the Columbia School of Public Health. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Naheed Toubia. She's the director of Rainbow, a group active in the global campaign to eradicate female genital mutilation. How widespread is the practice of female genital mutilation now? What is the typical age it's done?
Worldwide, which is predominantly Africa, we think a rough estimate is about 130 million girls and women who have been affected by this. As I said, it's predominantly in a belt of Africa that kind of north and south of the equator across Africa. It's not known in the very northern part of Africa. That is mostly the Arab-speaking Africa doesn't know of this, except for Egypt and Sudan. And it's also not known in the southern part of Africa. Apart from Africa, some minorities in Asia, very small Muslim sect in India, about 500,000 people out of the 800 million or 1 billion inhabitants of India, who also practice it of the first type or the milder type. There are some reports that there might be some small groups in Yemen, maybe Oman in southern peninsula of the Arabian Peninsula. But it's not a big issue in Asia at this point in history. And then the third important and growing group is the immigrants, the African immigrants who now live in many countries where they were not born, particularly Europe, several countries of Europe, the United States, Australia and Canada. And they are raising a whole series of other issues in these new societies.
About whether the Western cultures should allow female genital mutilation or make it illegal?
Yes, that's one of the issues. I think the main thing that the immigration, especially from the Horn of Africa, Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia and Eritrea, which happened over the last 10 years in big numbers, and also where the severest forms are practiced, brought forth several questions. One of them, the legality issue. And I think it's a very important issue, but unfortunately it's an issue that almost overtook the other concerns. Partly, for instance, examples like how do these women now live in a system that suddenly from, how do they cope psychologically from feeling, you know, in absolutely pure and righteous and approved of in their society for having gone through this, to suddenly being victims and demonized and seen as kind of disabled freaks. That's quite a psychological transition for these people, and they need help. The other thing is very practical. How do they go to hospitals and get treated, and how do doctors deal with their bodies that are maimed and mutilated?
Doctors who've never seen anything like this before, for the most part.
Exactly. I mean, one of the things that we've been hearing about is that these women, a lot of them go through much higher rates of cesarean section because the doctors are just afraid to touch the genitals, while really what is needed is to deinfibulate, which is a very simple procedure and it's not anywhere as hazardous as a cesarean section. But many doctors who haven't seen it just, you know, they're afraid to touch anything in that area and they go straight into a cesarean section.
How long were you practicing medicine in Sudan?
I was a surgeon for about 15 years, mostly in Sudan, but partly in England, too.
Did you see many women and girls when you were practicing medicine in Sudan who had been genitally mutilated?
The rate in Sudan, at least in three-quarters of the country, other than the southern provinces, of genital mutilation is over 90%. So it was rare to see someone who's not mutilated in Sudan. As a matter of fact, when we were still students and training, it was difficult, I mean, to see women with normal genitals. And everybody thinks of women's genitals in this infibulated form, even the doctors themselves. So it becomes such a normal thing that people don't even question it after a while.
Were there a lot of medical problems related to infibulation that you had to treat?
Oh, a multitude. There weren't many cases of little girls coming in with complications because a lot of the time the families would prefer to take them back to the midwife or the circumcisors and not bring them to the doctors unless it was really severe and extreme. But a lot of problems we saw were with adult women. Women who would have cysts that grow over the scar from the embedded skin, from the stitching, that can grow, you know, up to the size of a melon before they would come to hospital. Girls who come because the infibulation after a while can just close altogether, so even the hole in the back might be sealed completely, so they have urine problems, or they might have started menstruating, but it's not showing outside, so their menstruation blood stays inside, and they're brought in by their families because they're suspected to be pregnant, because their stomach starts to get swollen. And of course, that becomes very dangerous. I mean, the girl would be under the risk of being killed or ostracized because they think she's pregnant. And all that's happening is her infibulation has sealed off completely. A lot of the problem I personally witnessed, and maybe that's a bias because people knew that I was more sympathetic to the women and to some of the issues they were going through, had to do with marital problems. I had a lot of newlyweds who were going through tremendous problems with regards, you know, how to consummate the marriage, some bleeding, infection. So both the psychological and the physical trauma of going through that initial marriage initiation, I witnessed a lot of that. And as I said, maybe because they knew I would be more sympathetic and more open to talking about sexual issues. So I saw more of these.
In America, we're supposed to have a more open attitude toward our bodies and so on. Women are still very shy and often very uncomfortable about their genitals. I wonder what the prevailing attitude is in Sudan. Were women very shy and uncomfortable about telling you about whatever problems they were having or allowing you to examine them?
You really got a very important point there, because let me tell you first one anecdote that I've had very recently. I was in Cairo and I was talking to this young woman who's doing her master's degree at the American University in Cairo. So it's a highly educated woman. She's from Sudan and she is infibulated. And we became kind of friends over the last couple of years. And we were talking for long hours over this and her feelings about it. And eventually what she really was able to express is, ever since that day, she had that cutting and she saw that piece of her body in the hands of the midwife, she just blocked her mind completely to her body and to her genitals. She stopped thinking about it. That area was taboo to her. She didn't want to go through the pain of thinking about it. She was very scared about thinking about it. So to her, the whole area of her genitals, her reproduction, her sexuality became a black, dark box that she should not think about. That's the way she expressed it. In more general terms, when you're in hospital, you find that hundreds of women come through the obstetrics and gynecology outpatient clinic complaining with very vague symptoms. They will start telling you about their recurrent headaches, their backache, their weakness in their bodies or weakness in their legs. And after a while, you actually gather a certain collection of symptoms that you know are really directing you towards their genitals and reproductive organs. When they start talking about something shooting up the bottom of their back down to their legs, what they're really saying is they're kind of like giving you all the signals towards their genitals, but cannot actually say that that's what they're worrying them. And you almost have to start after a while getting through all that and saying, okay, what are you really worried about? Do you have discharge? Are you worried about your infertility? Is it an issue of some problems, sexual problems with your husband? And you would have to bring it up. They just cannot talk about it.
Dr. Nahid Toubia teaches at the Columbia School of Public Health and is the director of Rainbow, a group active in the global campaign to eradicate female genital mutilation. She'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Dr. Naheed Toubia about the practice of female genital mutilation and its psychological and sexual impact on women. Dr. Toubia was the first woman surgeon in Sudan. We'll ask if she and the women in her family were circumcised. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second half of our interview with Dr. Naheed Toubia about the practice of female circumcision, which has also become known as female genital mutilation, or FGM. It's a rite of passage in which part of a girl's genitals are cut off. It's practiced in over 25 African countries. Dr. Toubia teaches at the Columbia University School of Public Health and directs Rainbow, a group that opposes FGM. Dr. Toubia is from Sudan, where female genital mutilation is still practiced. She was the first woman surgeon in Sudan. Did the women who you treated feel that there was anything unusual or possibly even unnecessary about the genital mutilation? Or did they believe that, no, this had to be done and sure there's complications, but this was an essential procedure?
That's a very difficult question to answer forthright. It's so complex in women's psychology how they perceive of this. There are several layers of acceptance and feelings about their mutilation. Sometimes the first reaction would be, of course, this is something necessary. This is something women have to go through. This is part of our culture. We have to go through this. I'll do it for my daughter. This is the absolute right thing to do. That might be the first answer. But if you probe further, you realize that partly that answer is because that's what they're socially expected to say. But also, it's how they cope with their pain. To accept that this has happened to you, but it's the right thing, also buries under it layers and layers of pain that you have to live with, layers of self-perception of being defective, of being faulty, yet seen as the norm at the same time. So if you just go and research people superficially and say, you know, what do you think of this? You'll find that the majority, maybe 80% of people say, oh, this is important, this is part of our culture. But more in-depth talking to women shows a well of sadness, a well of anger, a well of pain that is actually quite difficult, because once we get through those denial barriers that makes you survive this, we are trapped into a situation we don't know what to do with this women's pain and their anger. I've seen it recently in Denmark. I was speaking with Somali women who now live in Denmark, who have now recognized what's happened to them, accepted it, and started talking to each other about it. And the amount of pain and anger in their eyes, you just did not know what to do with it. I mean, it would need a tremendous amount of sensitive counseling, of coping with that pain to go beyond it and to be able to live with it and then decide, okay, this was wrong, I'm going to stop it in my daughter.
You said that you helped a lot of women with psychological and sexual problems that they were having. Can women enjoy sex at all if they've been mutilated? Is there any sexual pleasure they can experience?
Yes. I think the basic issue with sexuality is, of course, as we all know, as we all experience, sexuality is a combination of your anatomy, the actual physical stimulation of the genitals and the stimulation of other parts of the body. But it also has psychological components, emotional components, social structuring of sexuality, social taboos and norms and fantasies and all aspects of sexuality. So for mutilated women, genetically mutilated women, it's unquestionable that no matter how minimal the cutting, it does interfere with something physically. So it might be just part of the clitoris is removed or part of the clitoris and the labia. And of course, the more cutting, the more you're removing sensitive tissue. So there's no absolutes in this. But these women are also intact otherwise, although we also don't know how much the physical cutting has done psychological damage in terms of rejection of sex. And that's a very individual experience. It varies between a person to another. Some girls seem to have overcome that initial psychological impact of having your genitals removed, saying, throw your sex away. And they maintain their self-awareness as sexual beings, while others just decide, I'm not a sexual being, I have nothing to do with sex. So how that gets reversed or how that plays itself out when they actually have to become sexually active depends also on the circumstances under which they become sexually active.
Is it physiologically possible to have an orgasm if you've been infibulated?
If you've been infibulated, yes, but it, of course, is several times more difficult than if you just had a clitoridectomy or had type 2, which is clitoridectomy. Because even with clitoridectomy, the clitoris, the surface of what you cut out from the clitoris on the top is not the whole of the clitoris. There is more sensitive tissue buried inside, which the cutter doesn't always get to, or most of the time doesn't get to. But even with infibulation, even with a more dramatic cutting, I have genuinely talked to women who, over a long period of time, and very sensitive partners and open sexual relations have managed to achieve a degree of sexual satisfaction, including climaxing or orgasm. But it has to do with intensifying their emotional component, having to have a partner who's more sensitive to other erogenous zones in the body. I've known people who have almost substituted the erogenous zone from the clitoris to the nipples. So the most sensitive parts of their body becomes their nipples or their lips. It's almost like people who go blind, their hearing acuity becomes much higher. It's, the brain kind of substitutes the receptors from other parts of the body. So, I mean, it's very complex and it will vary from woman to woman and what her experience becomes.
My guest is Dr. Naheed Toubia. She's the director of Rainbow, a group active in the global campaign to eradicate female genital mutilation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're discussing female genital mutilation with Dr. Naheed Toubia, who was the first woman surgeon in Sudan, the country of her birth. She now teaches at Columbia School of Public Health. Were women any more or less willing to accept information and advice from you? As a woman doctor, you were the first woman surgeon in your country.
Yes, I think being a doctor and being a surgeon and having all that respect really gave me an edge, not only with women. If you get them alone, they are desperate to talk. It's not that they don't want to talk; they're desperate to talk. They're sometimes shy to talk in public, but give them a private environment, and they will not stop talking. But even amongst the bigger community, I used to go to villages where the first 10 rows in the audience would be the elderly men, the village leaders, the religious leaders of the village. And I was able to not only speak against the practice, but analyze it in terms of religion without being heavily challenged, talking about the most intimate anatomy in very open terms, you know, even holding a chalk and on a blackboard and drawing the genitals of men and women and drawing comparisons, talking about issues of sexuality. And it was seen as to be all right, although I was a young woman, a single woman, but being a doctor made a lot of difference. They didn't see it as me, you know, stepping my boundaries because I was seen as a respectable member of society.
What kind of reception did your criticisms get?
I think as a whole, people, when you first talk to them about it, it's just kind of, it's the first time it's a shock because they never really heard that much explanation about how wrong this is. Mm-hmm. Most of the time, they haven't even thought about it for most of their life.
It's just, this is the way it's done. This is what we do.
Exactly. I mean, my father, for instance, who is an extremely liberal man, allowed his two older daughters to be circumcised, not because he, I mean, if he stopped to think about it, he'd probably be extremely angry with himself. But he just didn't think about it. Nobody thought about it. It just happens. So, I mean, he encouraged us to be extremely liberal women, but this happened without him even blinking.
Were you one of those two oldest daughters?
No. So, I was the one who was the first one to be saved in the family.
Why you? I mean, why? What was the dividing line in your family?
The dividing line was my mother's maturity. My mother was married at the age of 16 out of high school. And you know, when you're that young a bride with your first child at 17, you just go with what your elders and what society tells you. By the time I came around, she was like late 20s, I think, early 30s. And she's a very self-educated woman. She constantly read. She kept herself informed about science, about women's issues. She's, in her own way, was a strong feminist of the 30s and 40s. And so when she gained that knowledge and she had her next daughter, there's 5 years difference between me and my older sister, she just said, this is wrong. And I think she probably recalled her old experience. And she decided this is not going to happen again to my daughters or to any girl born in my family or my neighborhood anymore. And although she didn't make it a big campaign, she just stood to her promise, and nobody else in the family was no woman was circumcised after that in the extended family.
So do you think that your life has been very different than the lives of your older sisters?
It's funny. I haven't really spoken to my sisters about this, really, to this day.
Was it taboo?
It's not taboo. It's painful. You know, sisters don't talk about their differences that easily. And I don't think we've found the comfort zone because I haven't been affected and they have. And that's always the problem with talking with women. It's already done. It's there. And there's a sense of you're not quite complete. You're not whole. And an inferiority issue. You know, you're just not. You don't want to feel that you're less than the other person, and it's very difficult, especially among siblings. I did speak about it to my mother this year for the first time, openly, about her own experience. She's 73 now, and we've just found the courage to speak not only about her experience when she was 5, and she remembers this vividly, but also her sexual experience in her marriage.
Why did you start talking about it now? How did it come up?
I think I've generally been very sensitive, maybe because I'm not being affected. I've never actually approached women and started the conversation about their sexuality or how they feel about themselves. I left it always to them to open the subject. But more in the last few years, maybe because people know more and more about me and my style and what I think, I've been approached by more women to talk about their most intimate experience. So that gave me the courage and gave me some of the experience of how to actually handle it and how to talk to women about it. And also I felt my mother's getting 73 and it would be really a shame if she died without me really exploring this with her.
Would it be violating her privacy if you told us her memories of what was done to her?
No, my mother is a very forthright woman, and she feels she has something to offer to the world. I think she'll feel proud that she can share this with the world. No, the way she described it, she said she was a little girl playing literally in the street in the dust with other kids, you know, when you don't even have a gender by then. You're kind of tomboyish and you play with the boys with whatever. And then just one day, without absolutely no preparation, she's heard about girls being circumcised. She sometimes would hear them screaming or know that, you know, a friend in school or someone in school has been in a lot of pain or being kept in bed because, but it was kind of a vague thing in her mind. And then just that day, they said, you know, today you're going to be circumcised. And she was literally picked up from the street and taken to a back room. And she said she felt like she was murdered. She felt that they literally were murdering her. And that image just stayed with her all her life. She just could not understand what was going on. She didn't get a lot of complications. So in some ways, it's kind of like after you heal, you're a child, you go back to playing. But she said that it affected her marital life, that sex to her was something she did not want to deal with. Every time my father got close to her, she just, all the pain and the trauma just flooded and the memories flooded in her mind. And that it took her a long time to accept what's going on. She started hating my father. She thought he was going to do something bad to her. Although she said he was an extremely gentle person and they cared for each other, she just thought that, you know, something is wrong with him. He wants to hurt her more. And it took her a long, long time. And without going into more details with me, she just said, well, it became all right, but it was never totally all right.
Did you ask her how she felt when your two older sisters were mutilated?
She didn't expand on that. She just said, you know, I wasn't really thinking about it. And they had a very, very mild form because we're Christians. And by that time, by that generation, the Christians were having a very, very minor form, you know, kind of like a partial clitoridectomy. And she just knew that when the time came and the age was right, you know, the family, the aunts, the mother, you know, my grandmother would say, oh, it's time for the girls to be circumcised. No, she didn't say that it was particularly traumatic. It's just one of those things that happened, like you see your kid go and have tonsillectomy or something.
Was there any kind of ritual surrounding her mutilation?
Not very big. As I've mentioned, we come from a Christian background, which has not got a lot of that ritual around it. It's just something that happens. Like almost the boys get circumcised, the girls get circumcised. Of course, right now with the Christians in Sudan, it's getting even less and less. Not many of them are circumcising still. But in the bigger society, we were a very, very small minority in Sudan. In the bigger society, majority Muslims, there is a big ritual. And it's not even, the ritual has nothing to do with the religion or Islam. It's a very, it's a ritual related more to the Nile. It's a very non-religious ritual, actually, where the girls get dressed up like brides and they put henna on their hands. Their hair gets made up. They wear gold. You know, they borrow their mother's gold or something, and they actually donned up like brides. And then after the circumcision, they are taken to the Nile to be washed in the Nile as almost a sacrifice to the Nile before they're brought back and some animal is slaughtered and a feast is started. And there's, you know, they distribute sweets and dates and nuts to the neighborhood, and there's dancing, and sometimes there's a singer. And the girl sits in bed and comes and be congratulated by everybody around her, and they give her gifts in, you know, of clothes, of money. So for those few days, she's actually a bride or, you know, a small princess.
My guest is Dr. Naheed Toubia. She was the first woman surgeon in Sudan, and she now teaches at the Columbia School of Public Health and heads a group that opposes female genital mutilation. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Nahid Tubia, and she's an activist around the issue of preventing female genital mutilation. And she's also an assistant professor of public health at Columbia University. She's from the Sudan, where she practiced medicine for 15 years. Female genital mutilation is defined by many people, including yourself, as a medical issue and a human rights issue. I'd like you to put this into a larger medical and human rights perspective for us.
From the medical point of view, I think we are now moving away from the attitude of the 60s and 70s even, that we should stop this because it has complications, that, you know, the girls will bleed or get infected or later on get, you know, complications of cysts or infertility. That is all true, and we are very concerned about that. But now we are defining it differently. We're saying not only the complications are the health problem is the actual cutting of a normal functioning body organ. Even if it went smoothly, if there were absolutely no complications, that still is a health problem. It's like poking someone's eye, and it should not be allowed based on medical ethics. That is very important because, first, it removes it from that physician attitude towards health, not as a normal state of being, but as a pathological state of being. You know, you don't get concerned about people's health unless it's a disease or a complication. So it's a movement within the health, international health circles about how you perceive of health. It also means that in terms of tactics and programs and policies within countries, at some points, and this issue comes coming up again and again, some people would say, okay, we know that this creates a lot of health problems, so let us do it in hospitals. Let's do it by doctors. Let's do it under hygienic conditions so that we can save all these complications. Now, if you only think of the complications and the problems, that might be a very reasonable solution. But if you think as the cutting itself, the damaging of a human body as the problem, then that would be totally unacceptable that a physician or a trained nurse or a certified health professional should ever do this. And this was very, very vital because even as recently as last year in Egypt, the Minister of Health in Egypt responded to a lot of pressure from the conservative circles in Egypt and passed a decree saying that this operation can be done in hospitals by doctors. Now, that was a reversal of a policy trend in Egypt since the 50s where doctors and trained professionals were not allowed to do this. Suddenly, he said they can do it in hospitals. And the women's groups and the progressive circles and the human rights group in Egypt just went up in arms. And because the argument was based on human rights, on health ethics, on the ethics of the profession to damage the body, regardless of whether there are complications or not, was brought to force. And because of that strong campaign, the minister was forced to reverse his decree this in 1995, 1 year later, and now made it illegal to perform it by any health professional. So all these are not just theoretical things. They really play out in the activism towards stopping this practice.
Put it into a human rights perspective for us.
In the human rights perspective, I think historically, again, human rights were only seen as an act by the state against the individual. That's the classic historical attitude of human rights where, you know, a state takes people who speak out their political views and put them in prison, torture them or kill them. Now, in the last maybe 5 to 7 years, several groups have been trying to push the human rights into a broader concepts of who are the parties who should be protected and who could be potentially the aggressor, and particularly the women's human rights movement, which has really made unbelievable progress in the last 5 years, especially in the Human Rights Conference in Vienna, where violence against women within the home was started or have been recognized as a violation of human rights. So the aggressor no longer has to be the state. It could be a private subject. It could be, you know, rape in the street is a human rights violation. husband beating up his wife is a human rights violation, and therefore parents accepting circumcision or mutilation of their children's genitals is a human rights violation. So human rights were taken from just the public domain, where it's just the state against individual, to the more private domain, where family members, clan members can actually violate each other's human rights. And that is also extremely important, because in many countries, the idea that parents could be taken to court for violating their own children's human rights is very, very new and still shocking to a lot of people. Parents still believe that they own their children.
This is one of the most important issues in your life. Why?
Because it's the ultimate of victimization of women. A victimization that not only physically injures women and takes from them something that is very private and very personal and theirs by right, their sexuality. And also because people are afraid to talk about it, and people are afraid to talk about women's rights to their sexuality, no matter what that sexuality is. So to me, it sort of encapsulates what I stand for in life. And also because women in this particular case have the extreme of being programmed to accept their subordination. And if we can get through the barrier of this one, we can almost tackle anything else.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Dr. Naheed Toubia teaches at the Columbia School of Public Health, and she directs RAINBOW, the Research Action and Information Network for Bodily Integrity of Women, which is based in New York. Our interview was recorded last year. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tenenbaum. Research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.